Thank you, Sandy, for the introduction. Thank you, everyone, for attending. Let me just mention, since we're at the Supporter Summit, before I dive into the more academic-y material here, I do want to just say that I think sometimes we might take it for granted of just how much good that the Mises Institute does and how, of course, that's all just due to the support from the generous donors. So I do want to acknowledge it. And just to let you know, just to assure you that your money is going to a worthy cause, because I've been around to other types of conferences, even ones not just where the attendees are like young libertarian types, but even those of an explicitly Austrian flavor. And there's just nothing even in the same zip code as the Mises Institute, you know, their flagship event, the Mises University. And I mean, I suppose that's literally true because they're not all located in Auburn, so they're different zip codes, but you get what I'm saying. Just, I'm saying even metaphorically speaking, and it's, you know, because you'll go to other conferences and young people will come up and they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, I watch John Stossel, I'm kind of interested in liberty and stuff like that, you know, and I'm not, that's good. Like, I'm not trying to like disparage those other inroads, but I'm saying like at Mises University, I'll have 17-year-olds coming up to me and saying, yeah, on your study guide to the theory of money and credit, you said this in footnote 12 and you're wrong. And, you know, and what's really interesting is half the time the kids are right. And so those are the occasions when I say, sorry, Joe Salerno needs me. I got to say, all right. All right. So what are we talking about here? You know, I don't have too much time here. We're trying to do rapid fire. Let me also mention, in case that some of you are new to this, it used to be historically at these types of events, the speakers would go for like 45, sometimes an hour. And then they just started, you know, reducing it. And economists are good on optimization. And so each time they kept reducing it and to see, like, no, they're actually better the less time we give them to speak, that the audiences get more utility from it. And so we'll see what the lower limit is on that. But what I'm going to be talking about today is only the Austrians can defeat central banking. So here, obviously, this is going to be a whirlwind presentation. And what I'm going to do is just show you some representative quotations from various thinkers corresponding to popular schools of thought in economics on their view of central banking specifically. Okay, or maybe they're talking about the Fed or something, but anyway, you'll get the gist of it. So what I'm trying to do here, obviously I don't have time to give you a full-blown summary and say, ah, this is what the Keynesians think and here's their views and it's a liquidity trap and the reasons that that's problematic or we don't have time to do that, but I want to just show here and get on the record that if you agree, and the theme of this conference, of course, underscores this, that the central bank is the engine or the vehicle through which the minions of the state accomplish all sorts of nefarious deeds, that the school of thought, you know, which one is most poised to be able to stop that? So that's not a very scientific statement, right? Like critics hearing me say that would say, ah, see, he's admitting he already knows what the answer has to be. He's going to backfill. And yeah, you can say that. So the Austrian school stands on its own. I can go through logically and defend it. And that's what, you know, I've done in my work and Joe Salerno and Jeff Herdman and everyone else you're hearing from today. That's what we do in our scholarly work. But I just want to assure members of the public, like if they're trying to understand, like, you know, who are we rooting for in terms of these academic disputes? I want to just show the importance of the Austrian school. And in particular, what you're going to see with some of these representatives, even other schools of thought that on many policy issues tend to be very free market, laissez-faire friendly. And so a lot of people sometimes say, like, why are you Austrians? You know, you're so insular and you're just idiosyncratic and you're all in the corner by yourself and you have this gatekeeping and you're better than everybody else. Well, the answer is because we're better than everybody else. I mean, that's, but wait for applause. Besides that, though, it's also just because they do have a unique perspective, all right? So it's not that, oh, we're basically saying the same thing as Milton Friedman, as we'll see in a moment. All right, so since I'm burning too much time here, let's jump right into it. So the first one is my good buddy, Paul Krugman. And let me mention, now this comes up a lot. What I'm trying to underscore in this talk, I think I realized this, like I had already sent the slides in, and then I realized it just this morning, that really what I'm trying to show you here, I'm not going to try to show you like, oh, we're smarter than the other economists. What I'm trying to show you is that we're wiser. Okay, so that's the thing to keep in mind with these quotes is I want to show you it's not a matter of technical expertise. A lot of these economists are very smart. So like Paul Krugman, he's not a dummy, okay? Now, he does say some dumb things, but it's not because he's dumb. It's because he's evil, right? And so there's a distinction. Right, and so this came up a lot. As many of you know, Tom Woods and I had a longstanding podcast called Contra Krugman, and that was a point that we would come up, a lot of our fans would, you know, oh, Krugman's such a more, and we would clarify and say, no, Krugman is very intelligent, right? I'm not saying he's smarter than me. I'm saying he's smarter than Tom. That's what, if you want to calibrate it. Okay. So that's not the issue, right? And it's, in fact, precisely because he's so intelligent, that's why he's so dangerous, right? Because he knows, like, oh, I have to justify this crazy thing. It flies in the face of conventional economics even, so how can I do it? And he'll come up with a way, right? That's the idea. Okay, so let me go ahead and just start reading these. This was from when Ben Bernanke was reappointed as Fed chair in August of 2009. And this is what Krugman wrote in his New York Times column. Ben Bernanke's performance over the past year deserves praise, and there's nobody I'd rather have in his position. Congratulations, Ben. Okay, and so I don't think I need to dwell too long to show if you're worried about the central bank being an engine of war and oppression around the world, Krugman's not the guy to stand up to it, right? Just with the way he's writing that. And also, what's really interesting, just to see how smarmy he is, or I don't know what adjective you want to use, if you go through and read his post, you know, I had the dot, dot, dot there, earlier he was saying how, now it's true, Ben Bernanke completely missed the housing bubble. And he links to a thing showing Ben Bernanke, like as of 2006, telling everybody, don't worry, this is contained to the subprime sector. And then he goes on to say, nonetheless, even though he completely missed this crisis coming, there's nobody I'd rather have at the helm than him, right? And so that's kind of a weird thing. It's because he actually doesn't mean it, right? That this, it's even as annoying as this quote is to hear him praising Ben Bernanke, if, given our views of Ben Bernanke, it's like Krugman doesn't even mean it, so it's extra annoying. But okay, we don't have time to dwell on that. Let's move on. Okay, modern monetary theory, or MMT. Let me just take the opportunity, as I have often done for years, I have been raising the alarm bell on this, right? So it's like, if the conventional history of World War II were accurate, I would be like the Winston Churchill warning about, guys, this is the threat that everyone's ignoring. Since it's not accurate, I don't know if that just means I'm a war criminal, but in any event, we'll put that aside. I gotta get Tucker Carlson to interview me about that. So let me just say though here, so what I mean in terms of them being the threat is they're different from standard Keynesianism. All right. So Paul Krugman in particular had a debate with Stephanie Kelton, in various, he was doing it from his perch at the New York Times. I don't remember where she was publishing it, but they were going back and forth. And Krugman, believe it or not, I was actually sympathetic to him, that he complained that, oh yeah, these MMTers, they're playing Calvin ball, right? So that's a reference to Calvin and Hobbes. And so in that comic strip, the game Calvin ball, it means that Calvin always wins because if he just changes the rules on you, like mid-game, just to say, oh, well, this is an extra point or whatever, So that's the way, so Krugman's point was, I can go ahead and state my case is about, well, yes, the Fed has these constraints and blah, blah, blah. And then Kelton would just change the argument and say, oh, no, but what I'm talking about is if we're just focusing on inflation, then this happened. And he's like, okay, but that's not what, all right. So, and then he'll just change and deal with her latest, and then she'll just move the goalposts again and then change. So that was his point. And he actually, in terms of their debate, again, I was sympathetic to him, but that doesn't matter. The point is who is resonating with the young progressive types, and it's the MMTers, partly for demographic reasons, right, that Krugman's an old white man and Larry Summers and all those guys are all old white men, and there's a lot of more diversity in conventional measures among the MMT crowd, but also because the MMTers are giving the promise of this, going to what Joe Salerno was talking about, the Santa Claus principle versus scarcity. The MMTers, more than any other school of thought, are almost literally telling people, don't worry, the government can just run the printing press. Now, they're usually, when someone objects, they'll say, oh, no, we don't mean that. But they mean that, right, in terms of what they're telling the public, okay? Or they're just saying, don't worry, we can have single-payer healthcare. We can have a Green New Deal. We can do all these other things. And don't let those fuddy-duddy economists tell you that, oh, there's opportunity cost. No, they're saying that's wrong. So here's just the representative quotation. So she wrote this in March of 2020. So this is right when, the COVID lockdowns were being implemented. It's all laid bare. There's no going back. We hold mainstream economists and beltway gatekeepers to fool us into believing that the federal government faces financial constraints akin to those faced by households, business, and state governments no more. Now, I was on the fence, but until she put that hashtag no more, then I was like, that's it. You've convinced me. All right. I could spend a whole, 20 minutes on this, but I can't. I got to move on. Okay, the Chicago School. So this quote, let me just, I'll read it to you, and then I'll explain why I picked this one. At first, you're going to think this is a kind of a a poor quote to represent somebody's point of view, Bob, because it's kind of without context and it's meandering. But that's kind of my point. So let me just read it first, and then I'll explain why I chose it. So this is Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. They had written a very important book in the monetary history of the United States that kind of overturned what the profession thought had happened in the 30s. And in 1987, they had an article for the National Bureau of Economic Research that, I forget the exact title, it was something like, is there a role for the state in money? Question mark, right? So that's what they were asking. And so the context here is he was reviewing like the SNL crisis and such in the, you know, in the 1980s. So they're writing from the perspective of 1987. Here's what he said. These episodes show that what used to be called the inherent instability of a fractional reserve banking system is unfortunately still alive and well. What they do not show, and what is still an open question, is whether a government lender of last resort, a central bank, is necessary and desirable as a cure. It did not prove to be a cure in the U.S. in the 1930s. It did in the Continental Illinois case, as well as in some earlier episodes. And whether a satisfactory cure or not, is the emergence of a lender of last resort a likely or unavoidable consequence of financial development? Okay, so here it gives the appearance of being very even-handed and open-minded. And certainly if you're a professional economist, and especially if you're interested in money and banking, you got to read, you know, Friedman and Schwartz's material. Obviously, I'm not saying you shouldn't, and you will learn a lot of relevant history. You know, I trust when they're reporting historical views about this is what happened under the bimetallic period in the U.S. and that I trust them as a source for me to just learn the basic raw facts before I then try to analyze them. But here, so what they're doing, he's again trying to be very even-handed and saying having a lender of last resort, because that's one of the functions of a central bank ostensibly, it didn't work in the 30s, right? Because he's saying the Fed failed. He blames the Great Depression on the Fed. It didn't inflate enough. Okay, so even there, the failure of the Fed, in his point, isn't that it inflated a bubble in the 20s, the way Rothbard would have argued, or did argue, but rather Friedman saying the Fed was asleep at the wheel, you know, Benjamin Strong died and whatever, and so there was a power vacuum, and that the Fed should have pumped in way more base money in the early 30s, and they refrained from doing that, and hence, we went through all the trouble of getting this lender last resort, and then they didn't even do that when the situation called for it. So he's saying, you know, it failed in the 30s, but he's praising them in the Continental Illinois case. That if, you know, in this article, they had earlier just explained how the Federal Reserve branch near that bank came in and rescued them by, you know, promising liquidity and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so even on his own terms there. And then he pivots from, as economists, is this a good thing or a bad thing, to is it politically viable, right? And so that's kind of the whole article. It's like 20-ish pages long, this whole article where they're assessing, is there a role for the state in money? And what's interesting is you can read the whole thing and genuinely not know what their conclusion is at the end. I literally tweeted this out, that title, and I said, hey, economist friends, what is their answer in this? Like, I was getting ready for this talk to you guys, and I wanted to be able to say, and the only person who answered was George Selgin. As Joe Salera knows, George Selgin has an opinion on everything, but he was the only one to even venture to say this is what their answer was, and he disagreed with them. Okay, so that's my point to you is, the fact that this quotation is kind of like all over and meandering and all these ways on the one hand, and on the other hand, that's what their whole article is. So clearly, if you want to find somebody that's going to stand up to the central bank, it's not going to be from this source. Okay. The so-called market monetarists are the descendants of the Chicago School monetarist tradition. In my book for the Mises Institute, Understanding Money Mechanics, I have a whole chapter on this new school of thought. So if you want to go in that, you know, that's free online if you want to go look that up. But this guy, Scott Sumner, is clearly their hero. He's got a spot at the, or he did at least, I don't know if he still holds it, at the Mercatus Center. Okay, so this guy is who a lot of even self-described Austrians, but who are not in the Auburn wing of that movement or whatever you want to call it, discipline. This is one of their guys that they hold up as this is one of the best monetary theorists of our day. Okay, and so here, let me just, could arguably be unfair, but he wrote this. We are entering a golden age of central banking where the Fed will become more effective and come closer to hitting its targets than at any other time in history. Over the next few decades, inflation will stay close to 2% and the unemployment rate will generally be relatively low and stable. In fact, Fed policy is becoming more effective because it's edging gradually in a market monetarist direction. As an analogy, when I was young, I would frequently read about airliners crashing in the U.S. After each crash, problems were fixed and planes got a bit safer. Recessions and airline crashes, they're getting less frequent and for the exact same reason. So you might say, oh, when did he, you know, did he write that in the 90s or something? No, he wrote it in January 2020. So a little bit awkward. Okay, so if I had longer time, I would be fairer and give him the context and the excuses. But no, we don't have time, so haha, Scott. Okay, what about the Chicago School finance guys? So this is a distinct group of individuals, okay? And again, here, when I made that distinction between being smart and wise, with these guys in particular, they're very good at math. So this is the stuff like the efficient markets hypothesis. William Sharpe is one of the guys, Eugene Fama, Harry Markowitz. The guys, like if you've heard of the Sharpe ratio, I know a lot of you are in the financial sector. If you've heard that term, it comes from this guy, William Sharpe, who's in this genre, if you will. So anyway, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And also for those of you who are young and up and coming Austrian economists that are going to do scholarly work, when people ask me, hey, I'm looking for something to do my dissertation on or my master's thesis, what do you suggest? I mean, the obvious first thing is it's got to interest you. Like, you got to get up in the morning. You can't wait to get back to doing it. That's going to, you know, help the quality of it and keep your stamina up. But in terms of if they really just need to know, I will say in quantitative finance, that's closer to Austrian verbal analysis than, like, the neoclassical economic framework is. And so I say that you can get your foot in the door and like try to translate Austrian insights into their framework, and it's you're not going to have to compromise as much. Like their notion of equilibrium is just a no arbitrage condition. Like there can't be any pure profit opportunities. That's what these finance guys and their mathematical models mean by equilibrium, as opposed to like a long run stasis. The things just keep repeating in terms of like a more mainstream neoclassical economics model. But anyway, even despite the fact that I think there is some promise in collaboration, and a lot of these guys are very free market oriented, and some of them, like if you read, like if you've heard of Fisher Black, he's a very deep thinker. Like he just goes off on things. But he says, just John Cassidy's interviewing him, and he says, many people would argue that in this case, the inefficiency was primarily in the credit markets, not the stock market. There was a credit bubble that inflated and ultimately burst. And then Fama says, I don't even know what that means. People who get credit have to get it from somewhere. Does a credit bubble mean that people save too much during that period? I don't know what a credit bubble means. I don't even know what a bubble means. These words have become popular. I don't think they have any meaning. Okay, and so the problem there is that, again, he's defined bubbles out of existence. And again, if we had more time to be fair, we could go through and explain why he's saying that. But my point is just, if your model's leading you after, you know, in 2010 to say, I don't even know what you mean by the word bubble, that's not going to help anybody, right? That's not going to solve real world problems. And the last thing, and I'm sorry, over time, let's read the wisdom from Mises and I'll stop. He wrote this in 1949. Looking backward upon the history of the last 100 years, one cannot help realizing that the blunders committed by liberalism in handling the problems of banking were a deadly blow to the market economy. There was no reason whatever to abandon the principle of free enterprise in the field of banking. The majority of liberal politicians simply surrendered to the popular hostility against money lending and interest taking. So again, I don't want to give the wrong impression and say that the Austrians aren't very smart and they don't have rigorous analysis. They do, but I'm saying it's not just that, but where they're focusing their energies is in the right spot. Like the Austrians, like the great ones like Mises and Rothbard, understood the threat posed by central banking to human liberty and flourishing. And that's why they were particularly, interested in focusing on these topics. To them, it wasn't merely an intellectual pastime. They understood what was at stake. And so for that, the Austrian School continues to be very important. And we again thank you all for your support. Thanks.